Later that week, Isabel took Pansy to a great party. Pansy was never in want of partners, and very soon after their arrival, she gave Isabel, who was not dancing, her bouquet to hold. Isabel had rendered her this service for some minutes when she became aware of the presence of Edward Rosier. He looked at her somewhat fiercely, and then dropped his eyes on the bouquet. "It's all Pansy's. It must be hers," he said softly. "May I have one flower, Mrs. Osmond?" Isabel hesitated a moment, and then held out the bouquet. "Choose one, but don't put it in your buttonhole."
"I should like Pansy to see it. She has refused to dance with me, but I believe in her still."
"Her father has told her not to talk to you, and she'll never disobey him. But she's coming back to me," Isabel added, "and you must go away." Rosier lingered a moment till Pansy came near, and then he walked away. Pansy took the bouquet, and Isabel saw she was counting the flowers. But she said nothing before being taken onto the dance floor again. She had not been absent many minutes when Isabel saw Lord Warburton approaching. He bade her good evening.
"Where's the little maid?"
"She's dancing." He looked among the dancers and then said,
"Won't you dance with me?"
"Thank you. I'd rather you should dance with the little maid."
"Of course I will, if you like."
"If I like? Oh, if you dance with her only because I like it." Isabel stood staring at him. "Lord Warburton, you told me 10 days ago you'd like to marry my stepdaughter. You've not forgotten it."
"Forgotten it? I wrote to Mr. Osmond about it this morning."
"Ah," said Isabel. "He didn't mention it to me."
"Well, I didn't send my letter, but I shall send it tomorrow."
"You still wish to marry her?"
"Very much indeed."
Isabel said no more, and Lord Warburton looked about him. He had noticed a melancholy youth staring at them, and he asked Isabel who he was. "It's the young man who's in love with Pansy."
"He looks rather bad."
"He has reason. My husband won't listen to him. He hasn't money enough."
"Dear me. He looked a well-set-up young fellow. How much money has he got?"
"Some 40,000 francs a year."
£1,600. "Ah, but that's very good, you know."
"So I think," replied Isabel. "But you seem very interested in your rival."
"My rival? Do you call him my rival?"
"Surely, if you both wish to marry the same person."
"Yes, but since he has no chance."
"Pansy would like to think he had." A quick blush sprang to Lord Warburton's brow.
"You told me she would have no wish apart from her father's, and as I've gathered that he would favour me."
"Yes, I told you she has an immense wish to please her father."
"That seems to me a very proper feeling," said Lord Warburton.
"Certainly." Isabel paused. "But it hardly strikes me as the sort of feeling to which a man would wish to be indebted for a wife." Lord Warburton looked quickly at his friend.
"Why are you so unwilling, so skeptical?"
She met his eyes, and for a moment they looked straight at each other. She saw in his expression the gleam of an idea that she was uneasy on her own account. It told her what she wanted to know. The Countess Gemini was often extremely bored. She lived with her eyes upon Rome, and it was the constant grievance of her life that she had not an habitation there. She heard a great deal about Isabel and knew she was having a beautiful time. She had indeed seen it for herself when she had spent a week at Palazzo Rocconera during the first winter of her brother's marriage, but she had not been encouraged to renew this satisfaction, at least up till now. She had recently had an invitation from Osmond himself. Several days before the Countess was due to start for Rome, Henrietta Stackpole called upon her. They had met briefly at Mrs. Touchett's.
"I seem to remember that when I saw you before, you were very interesting. I made use of some of your comments afterwards in an article."
"Dear me!"
cried the Countess, staring and half alarmed. I had no idea I ever said anything remarkable. I didn't mention your name. I only said a lady of high rank. Oh, I wouldn't have minded, said the Countess. I'm not at all like my brother. Now, if you were to quote him in your paper, he'd never forgive you.
He needn't be afraid. I shall never refer to him, said Miss Stackpole with bland dryness.
That's another reason why I wanted to come to see you. Mr. Osmond has never liked me, but now he has tried to break up my relations with Isabel, so I'm going to Rome.
So am I, the Countess cried. We'll go together.
Are you staying with Isabel?
No. I wrote to her I was coming, and she answered that she would engage a room for me at a pensione. She gave no reason.
The reason's Osmond.
Isabel ought to make a stand, said Miss Stackpole. I'm afraid she has changed a great deal. Have you any idea what is happening?
I see and hear very little of Osmond, the Countess shrugged.
Do you know Lord Warburton?
I know him very well.
I don't know him, but I'm told he's making love to Isabel.
Making love to her? So I'm told. I don't know the details, said the Countess lightly.
Henrietta gazed earnestly at her companion.
Do you mean that Isabel's guilty?
Oh, dear, no, not yet, I hope.
I only mean that Osmond's very tiresome, and that Lord Warburton, as I hear, is a great deal at the house.
I'm afraid you're scandalized.
No, I'm just anxious, Henrietta said. I shall leave for Rome tomorrow.
Dear me, I'm sorry. I can't leave for a week. I'm having some dresses made.
I'm told Isabel receives immensely. But I shall see you there. I shall call on you at your pensione.
On leaving the Countess, Henrietta made her way to the center of Florence. Armed with a map, she located a small tourist hotel and asked the porter if Mr. Goodwood was at home.
I'm very pleased to see you, Caspar Goodwood said as he met her.
It was not to please you I came, replied Henrietta. I want you to do me a favor. I want you to consider whether it's a good thing on the whole for you to go to Rome.
I thought you were going to say that, he answered rather artlessly.
You have considered it, then?
Of course I have, very carefully. Otherwise I shouldn't have come so far as this. I was thinking it over when I saw you in Paris 2 months ago.
I'm afraid you decided it was best for you first and Mrs. Osmond next.
Oh, it won't do her any good. I just want to see her myself.
Won't it do her some harm? That's the question.
Caspar Goodwood stared at her.
Have you heard something about her?
Yes, I've heard. But as I don't want you to go to Rome, I won't tell you.
Just as you please. I shall see for myself. You've heard she's unhappy.
Oh, you won't see that, Henrietta exclaimed.
Isabel went to visit Ralph at his hotel the day after the dance. Osmond had not yet formally forbidden her to call upon her cousin, but she felt sure that unless Ralph should very soon depart, this prohibition would come. How could poor Ralph depart? The weather as yet made it impossible. She came very soon to what she wished to speak of.
I want you to answer me a question, Ralph. It's about Lord Warburton.
I think I can guess your question,
Ralph answered from his armchair.
Please, then, answer it.
Oh, I don't say I can do that.
You're intimate with him, she said. Is he really in love?
Very much, I think.
Ah, said Isabel dryly. It's after all no business of mine.
You're very philosophic.
Ralph stared at her.
May I inquire what you're talking about?
I thought you knew. Lord Warburton tells me he wants to marry Pansy. Is it your belief that he really cares for her?
Ah, for Pansy? No,
cried Ralph very positively.
But you said just now he did.
Ralph waited a moment.
that he cared for you, Mrs. Osmond.
Oh, Ralph, you give me no help, she cried abruptly and passionately. It was the first time she had alluded to the need for help, and the words shook her cousin with their violence. It seemed to him that at last the gulf between them had been bridged.
How unhappy you must be, he murmured tenderly.
He had no sooner spoken than she recovered her self-possession. When I talk of your helping me, I talk great nonsense, she said with a quick smile. The matter's very simple. Lord Warburton must get on by himself.
He'll do nothing dishonorable, said Ralph.
I'm very sure of that. Nothing can be more honorable than for him to leave the poor child alone. She cares for another person.
But your husband surely won't like that.
Isabel hesitated, frowning a little. Are you pleading Lord Warburton's cause?
Not in the least. I'm very glad he shouldn't become your stepdaughter's husband. It makes a very queer relation to you,
said Ralph, smiling.
But I'm rather nervous lest your husband should think you haven't pushed him enough.
He knows me well enough not to have expected me to push. Her mask had dropped for an instant, but she had pulled it on again. Ralph had an almost savage desire to hear her complain of her husband, hear her say that she should be held accountable for Lord Warburton's defection.
You'll be decidedly at variance all the same, he said in a moment.
He saw she was nervous, afraid of what he might say. It's a matter we can hardly quarrel about, for almost all the interest is on his side. Pansy's, after all, his daughter. Isabel put out her hand to wish him goodbye. Ralph took an inward resolution that she shouldn't leave him without his letting her know that he knew everything.
Do you know what his interest will make him say? He asked as he took her hand.
She shook her head.
It will make him say that your want of zeal is owing to jealousy.
He stopped a moment. Her face made him afraid. To jealousy?
To jealousy of his daughter.
She blushed red. You're not kind, she said in a voice he had never heard.
Be frank with me and you'll see.
But she made no reply. She only pulled her hand out of his own and rapidly withdrew from the room. Isabel made up her mind to speak to Pansy, and she went to the girl's room before dinner that day. Pansy was sitting by the fire, and Isabel sat beside her. What Isabel wished to do was to hear from Pansy's own lips that her mind was not occupied with Lord Warburton. But if she desired the assurance, she felt herself by no means at liberty to provoke it. The girl's father would have qualified this as rank treachery. When Isabel broached the subject, Pansy begged her for advice. It's difficult for me to advise you, Isabel returned. That's for your father. I think I should like your advice better than Papa's, Pansy said quietly. A lady can advise a young girl better than a man. Well, perhaps I can try to learn what you desire and act accordingly. Pansy presently told her that the only thing she wanted in life was to marry Mr. Rosier. He had asked her, and she had told him she would do so if her papa would allow it. Now her papa wouldn't allow it. Then it's impossible, Isabel announced. You must think of something else. What should you like me to do? Pansy softly demanded. The question was a terrible one, and Isabel took refuge in timorous vagueness. To remember all the pleasure it's in your power to give to your father. To marry someone else, you mean? Yes.
The child stared at her. Isabel believed she was doubting her sincerity. Then she stood up and quavered, "Well, I hope no one will ask me." Isabel also got up and stood a moment looking into the fire. "Lord Warburton has shown you a great attention. He's very kind, and I like him very much, but if you mean that he'll propose for me, I think you're mistaken." "Perhaps I am, but your father would like it extremely." Pansy shook her head.
"Lord Warburton won't propose simply to please Papa. He knows I don't want to marry, and he therefore won't trouble me. And he doesn't care for me either."
"Perhaps you should tell your father that," remarked Isabel reservedly. "You oughtn't to let him have false hopes."
"Maybe not. But so long as he believes that Lord Warburton intends anything of the kind, Papa won't propose anyone else. And that will be an advantage for me," said the child very lucidly.
Isabel drew a long breath. She felt relieved of a heavy responsibility. Lord Warburton was not seen in Mrs. Osmond's drawing-room for several days, and Osmond was in a state of expectancy. At the end of 4 days, he alluded to his absence.
"What has become of Warburton?"
"I saw him last Friday at the German ball," Isabel said. "He told me then that he meant to write to you."
"He has never written to me. Be so good as to remind him."
"You expect too much of me."
"Ah, yes. I expect a great deal of you."
"I'm afraid I shall disappoint you."
"My expectations have survived a good deal of disappointment."
"Of course I know that. Think how I must have disappointed myself. If you really wish hands laid on Lord Warburton, you must lay them yourself."
"That won't be easy, with you working against me."
Isabel started. "I think you accuse me of something very base," she returned.
"I accuse you of not being trustworthy. If he doesn't come forward, it will be because you've kept him off."
At this moment, a servant came in, followed the next by Lord Warburton. He looked rapidly from the master of the house to the mistress. Osmond was embarrassed. He found nothing to say. But Isabel remarked, promptly enough, that they had been in the act of talking about their visitor. Upon this, her husband added that they had been afraid he had gone away.
"No,"
Lord Warburton explained, smiling.
"I'm only on the point of going."
And then he mentioned that he found himself suddenly recalled to England. For a moment, neither of his companions spoke. Osmond only leaned back in his chair, listening. Isabel didn't look at him. She could only fancy how he looked. Lord Warburton sat there a quarter of an hour, talking as if he might not soon see them again, unless indeed they should come to England, a course he strongly recommended. Why shouldn't they come to England in the autumn? It would give him much pleasure to have them come and spend a month with him. It would amuse Miss Osmond as well. He asked if she were not at home. Couldn't he say goodbye? Osmond rose at this point.
"If you'll excuse me, I'll see if my daughter's disengaged. Of course, when you come to Rome, you'll always look us up. Mrs. Osmond will decide about the English expedition."
The nod with which, instead of a handshake, he wound up the conversation was perhaps a rather meager form of salutation, but on the whole it was all the occasion demanded.
"I hope he'll make Miss Osmond come,"
Lord Warburton remarked.
"I want very much to see her."
"I'm glad it's the last time," said Isabel.
"So am I. She doesn't care for me."
"No, she doesn't care for you." They talked a little of Ralph, and in another moment Pansy came in.
"I'm going away," Lord Warburton said. "I want to bid you goodbye."
"Goodbye, Lord Warburton."
"And I want to tell you how much I wish you may be very happy."
"Thank you, Lord Warburton."
He lingered a moment and gave a glance at Isabel.
"You ought to be very happy. You've got a guardian angel."
Then he shook hands with Isabel in silence, and presently he was gone.
"I think you are my guardian angel,
Pansy exclaimed very sweetly. That evening after dinner, Gilbert Osmond went into his wife's sitting room. He stood by the fire a while and then said,
"I don't understand what you wish to do."
"I haven't the least idea what you mean."
"You've played a very deep game. You managed it beautifully."
"What is it you are accusing me of?"
"Of having prevented Pansy's marriage to Warburton."
"On the contrary, I took a great interest in it."
"You pretended to, and then you used your ingenuity to get him out of the way. Where's the letter you told me he had written me?"
"I haven't the least idea. I haven't asked him."
"You stopped it on the way," said Osmond.
Isabel stared at him. "Oh, Gilbert, for a man who was so fine," she exclaimed in a long murmur, and she left the room. It was from Henrietta Stackpole that Isabel learned how Caspar Goodwood had come to Rome, an event that took place 3 days after Lord Warburton's departure. This latter fact had been preceded by an incident of some importance to Isabel, the temporary absence, once again, of Madame Merle, who had gone to Naples. Madame Merle had ceased to minister to Isabel's happiness, who found herself wondering whether the most discreet of women might not also by chance be the most dangerous. It seemed to her that she had not done with her. This lady had something in reserve. Isabel was pleased to have her friend's company. Henrietta had crossed the stormy ocean in midwinter because she guessed that Isabel was sad. Henrietta guessed a great deal, but she had never guessed so happily as this. Isabel's satisfactions now were few, and it was a relief to confess to this confidant, the first person to whom she had owned it, that she was not in the least at her ease. Henrietta had herself approached this point without delay, and had accused her to her face of being wretched. "Yes, I'm wretched," Isabel said mildly. "What does he do to you?" "He does nothing. He doesn't like me."
"Why don't you leave him?" cried Miss Stackpole.
"I can't change that way. I married him before all the world. I can't publish my mistake." Henrietta gave a laugh.
"Don't you think you're rather too considerate?"
"It's not of him that I'm considerate. It's of myself."
It was not surprising Gilbert Osmond should dislike Miss Stackpole. His instinct had naturally set him in opposition to a young lady capable of advising his wife to withdraw from the conjugal roof.
Isabel said to Henrietta that she couldn't invite her to dine, but they could easily see each other in other ways. Isabel received Miss Stackpole freely in her own sitting room and took her repeatedly to drive. Caspar Goodwood eventually wrote that he would call at Palazzo Rocconera. Isabel wondered what he was coming for, what good he expected to get of it. He had presented himself hitherto as a person destitute of compromise, who would take what he had asked for or take nothing. Isabel's hospitality, however, raised no questions, and she found no great difficulty in appearing happy enough to deceive him. It was her conviction, at least, that she had deceived him, made him say to himself that she was happy. She never found out what he had come to Rome for. He offered her no explanation. There could be none but the very simple one, that he wanted to see her. In other words, he had come for his amusement, and this was exactly what she wanted. For if he cared for amusement, he had got over his heartache. She had been obliged to introduce him to Gilbert. It was impossible that she should not ask him to dinner, to her Thursday evenings, of which she had grown very weary, but which her husband still insisted on holding. To the Thursdays, Mr. Goodwood came regularly, solemnly. He appeared to regard them with a good deal of gravity. He got on much better with Osmond than had seemed probable, and Isabel could see that Mr. Goodwood thought better of her husband than he had ever wished to. One evening, Isabel bethought herself of saying to him that if he were willing,
he could render her a service. And then she added, smiling, I don't know, however, what right I have to ask a service of you.
You're the person in the world who has most right, he answered.
The service was that he should go and see her cousin Ralph, who was ill at the Hotel de Paris alone, and be as kind to him as possible. Mr. Goodwood had never seen him, but if she was not mistaken, Ralph had once invited him to Gardencourt. Caspar remembered the invitation perfectly, and felt sorry for the poor gentleman who lay dying at a Roman inn. He called at the Hotel de Paris, and on being shown into the presence of the master of Gardencourt, found Miss Stackpole sitting beside his sofa. She had not been asked by Isabel to go and see Ralph, but on hearing that he was too ill to come out, had immediately gone of her own motion. After this, she had paid him a daily visit, and they had become excellent friends. They talked about everything, and always differed, about everything, that is, but Isabel, a topic as to which Ralph always had a thin forefinger to his lips. Towards the end of February, Ralph Touchett made up his mind to return to England. He mentioned his intention to Henrietta. I suppose you know you can't go alone.
I shall have a servant with me, Ralph answered.
But you'll need a woman's care.
I've had so much of yours for the past fortnight that it will last me a good while.
You've not had enough of it yet. I'm coming with you. It won't be easy, but you had better go all the same. That same day, Caspar Goodwood visited Ralph, who informed his visitor that Miss Stackpole was to conduct him back to England.
Oh, said Caspar, Mrs. Osmond had made me promise to go with you. Good heavens, it's the golden age. You're all too kind, but there's really no need of your coming. Henrietta's extraordinarily efficient. I'm sure of that, but I've promised Mrs. Osmond, and she wants me to leave Rome. She thinks I'm watching her. Watching her? To see if she's happy. She's the most visibly happy woman I know, said Ralph. Exactly,
Goodwood answered dryly.
She pretends to be happy. I thought I should like to see for myself what it amounts to. I've seen, and I don't want to see any more. Do you know, I think it's time you should leave,
Ralph rejoined. And this was the only conversation these gentlemen had about Isabel Osmond. It was decided that the small party should leave the next day, and Ralph immediately pulled himself together for the departure. Isabel went to see him. I wish I could have seen more of you during your stay here, she said. But when one's married, one has so much occupation.
Fortunately, I'm not married. When you come to see me in England, I shall be able to entertain you with all the freedom of a bachelor.
Ralph talked as if they should certainly meet again, and made no allusion to his term being near, to the probability that he should not outlast the summer. If he preferred it so, Isabel was willing enough. She spoke of his journey, of the stages into which he should divide it, and the precautions he should take. With Henrietta at the head of your little band, she laughed, there will be nothing left for Mr. Goodwood.
Oh, my dear Isabel, there is nothing left for Mr. Goodwood.
She colored, and then observed quickly that she must leave him. They stood together a moment, holding hands. You've been my best friend, she said.
It was for you that I wanted to live. But I'm of no use to you.
Then it came over her more poignantly that she should not see him again. But she could not part with him that way. If you should send for me, I'd come.
I shall keep that for my last pleasure, said Ralph.
In answer to which she simply kissed him. It was a Thursday, and that evening Caspar Goodwood came to Palazzo Rocconera. He was among the first to arrive, and he had intended to leave early, but he found no chance to speak with Isabel. There were several people at the end who seemed tethered to the carpet. Osmond had disappeared. He never bade goodbye to people. Isabel had sent Pansy to bed. She at last sat a little apart, and Caspar Goodwood presently approached her.
May I talk to you?
She got up immediately, smiling. I suppose you wish to bid me goodbye.
Yes, but I don't like it. I don't want to leave Rome, he answered with almost plaintive honesty.
I can well imagine, but it's wonderfully good of you.
I don't care a straw for your cousin, Caspar suddenly broke out.
Is that what you wish to tell me?
No, I didn't want to tell you anything. I wanted to ask you, what have you really made of your life?
He said in a low, quick tone.
I can't understand. I can't penetrate you. What am I to believe? What do you want me to think?
Isabel said nothing. She only stood looking at him.
I'm told you're unhappy, and if you are, I should like to know it. That would be something for me. But you conceal everything. I haven't really come near you.
You've come very near, Isabel said gently, but in a tone of warning.
And yet I don't touch you. I want to know the truth.
You ask a great deal.
Yes, I've always asked a great deal.
He sensed that this was his last chance, that he loved her and had lost her.
When I tell you I love you, it's simply what I came for. I shouldn't say it if I didn't believe that I should never see you again.
You've behaved so well. Don't spoil it, she uttered softly.
No one hears me. I love you as I've never loved you.
I know it.
I ask nothing except one satisfaction, that you tell me.
That I tell you what?
Whether I may pity you.
Should you like that? Isabel asked, trying to smile.
To pity you? Most assuredly. I'd give my life to it.
Isabel's eyes rested a moment on his. Don't give your life to it, but give a thought to it every now and then. And with that, she left him. When Madame Merle returned from Naples, shortly after Lord Warburton's departure, she called on Isabel and immediately inquired after this nobleman. "Please don't talk of him," said Isabel. "But don't you know I had set my heart on his marrying Pansy?" Madame Merle insisted. "Do you think it's too late?" "You had better ask Pansy." "I shall ask her what you've said to her." Isabel perceived a critical tone in her visitor's attitude. And more clearly than ever before, she heard a cold, mocking voice inside her declare that this bright, strong, worldly woman was a powerful agent in her destiny. "As far as I'm concerned, it's all over," said Isabel. "But perhaps you would like to discuss the matter with Osmond."
"I already have. He came to see me last evening, and he judges you very severely."
Isabel made no answer to this. She felt choked with bitterness at the knowledge that Osmond dishonored her in his words as well as in his thoughts. And for the first time since she had known her, Isabel thought Madame Merle disagreeable.
"But I haven't come to scold you," Madame Merle continued. "I came, if possible, to learn the truth."
"What truth?" Madame Merle sat looking at her friend, judging the effect of her words.
"It would make a great difference to your husband's view of his daughter's prospects to know distinctly what really occurred. If Lord Warburton simply got tired of the poor child, that's one thing. If he gave her up to please you, it's another. In that case, could you not resign yourself to not being pleased, to simply seeing your stepdaughter married? Let him off. Let us have him. Isabel grew pale. Who are you? What are you? What have you to do with my husband? Ah, then, you take it heroically. I'm very sorry. Don't think, however, that I shall do so. What have you to do with me? Isabel went on. Madame Merle slowly got up. Everything. Isabel sat there, looking up at her. Her face was almost a prayer to be enlightened. But the light of this woman's eyes seemed only a darkness. Oh, misery, she murmured, covering her face with her hands. It had come over her like a high, surging wave that Mrs. Touchett was right. Madame Merle had married her. Before she uncovered her face again, that lady had left the room. On that same day in Madame Merle's apartment, Gilbert Osmond was seated, and his hostess stood before him. "I don't believe you're unhappy," said Madame Merle.
"Did I say I was unhappy?" Osmond answered gravely. "I'm just very tired."
"And what about me?"
"With you, it's just because you fatigue yourself. With me, it's not my own fault."
"When I fatigue myself, it's for you. I've given you an interest. You've never looked better. You've never been so agreeable, so brilliant. You express yourself more, too."
"I wish you would express yourself less," said Osmond sharply. "I don't understand what's the matter with you."
"The matter? The matter? The matter is that I would give my right hand to be able to weep, and that I can't."
"What good would it do you?"
"It would make me feel as I felt before I knew you. I was vile this morning to Isabel. I was horrid. You've made me as bad as yourself."
"To what do you want to provoke me when you say such things?"
"I've thought over all the harm you can do me," Madame Merle answered. "Isabel was afraid of me this morning, but in me it was really you she feared."
"Isabel's not afraid of me. You always see too much in everything."
Madame Merle stared at him. "It's only since your marriage that I've understood you."
"Well, if you didn't understand me before I married, it was cruelly rash of you to put me into such a box. However, I took a fancy to the box myself." "I asked very little. I only asked that my wife should like me."
"That she should like you so much?"
"That she should adore me, if you will."
"I never adored you," said Madame Merle.
"Ah, but you pretended to. But if my wife doesn't like me, at least my child does."
"If I had a child," Madame Merle said softly. Osmond paused.
"The children of others may be a great interest."
"There's something, after all, that holds us together, Gilbert."
"Is it the idea of the harm I may do you?"
"No, it's the idea of the good I may do for you. It's that," Madame Merle pursued, "that made me so jealous of Isabel. I want it to be my work." Her friend took up his hat.
"On the whole, I think you had better leave it to me."
"Have I been so vile, all for nothing?" Madame Merle wailed after he had left her.
Edward Rosier had been absent from Rome for some weeks. Nobody had known where, not even Pansy, when Isabel received a letter from him in Paris. He wrote that he had sold all his china, furniture, and enamels, and was in possession of $50,000.
"Now that I have money in my pocket, Mr. Osmond can't say I'm poor," he finished.
But Isabel knew that Mr. Osmond would say he was not wise. She did not mention the letter to Pansy, but that evening before dinner she found Pansy waiting in her room.
"Pardon my taking the liberty, but it will be the last for some time."
The child looked frightened. "You're not going away?"
"I'm going to the convent."
"Why?" Pansy sighed.
"Because Papa thinks it best. It's only for a few weeks. But please come and see me."
Isabel's answer to Pansy was a long, tender kiss. Isabel had forbidden herself ever to ask Osmond a question, so at dinner she simply said, "I shall miss Pansy very much."
"I've always had the idea that one's daughter should be innocent and gentle. Convents are very quiet, very salutary. She'll have time to think, and there's something I want her to think about."
Osmond spoke deliberately, reasonably. This struck a chill into Isabel's heart. It showed her just how far her husband was prepared to go. Pansy had taken fright. The impression her father desired to make would evidently be sharp enough. She would obey him. A week after this incident, Isabel received a telegram from England, from Mrs. Touchett.
"Ralph cannot last many days," it ran, "and if convenient, would like to see you."
Isabel went straight to her husband's study. "Excuse me for disturbing you," she said, "but Ralph's dying."
"Oh, I don't believe that," said Osmond, not looking round. "He was dying when we married. He'll outlive us all."
"My aunt has telegraphed for me. I must go to Gardencourt."
"Why?"
"To see Ralph before he dies."
"I don't see the need of it. He came to see you here. I didn't like his being here in Rome, but I tolerated it because it was to be the last time you should see him. Now you tell me it's not to have been the last."
"I must go to England," Isabel declared.
"I shall not like it if you do."
"Why should I mind that? You like nothing I do or don't do. You pretend to think I lie." Osmond gave a cold smile.
"That's why you must go, then? Not to see your cousin, but to take a revenge on me?"
"I know nothing of revenge."
"I do. Don't give me an occasion."
And he turned back to his table.
"I suppose that if I go, you'll not expect me to come back," said Isabel.
He turned quickly round and looked at her.
"Are you out of your mind? I really can't argue with you on the hypothesis of your defying me."
Isabel quickly left the room. Her faculties, her energy, her passion were all dispersed. On her way back to her room, she met the Countess Gemini.
"You look very badly," said her sister-in-law. "Will you let me comfort you? I know you're very unhappy."
"Yes, but I don't think you can help."
"Will you give me a try?"
said the Countess, following Isabel into her sitting room and sitting down beside her.
"There's something I want you to know," she declared, "because I think you ought to know it. Perhaps you've already guessed it."
"I've guessed nothing. I don't know what you mean."
Isabel felt a foreboding. The Countess stood up and stared at her.
"My first sister-in-law had no children."
"Your first sister-in-law?"
"I suppose you know at least that Osmond has been married before. His first wife lived hardly 3 years and died childless. It wasn't till after her death that Pansy arrived."
Isabel frowned. "Pansy's not my husband's child, then?"
"Your husband's imperfection. but someone else's wife. Oh, my good Isabel, cried the Countess. With you one must dot one's I's. The lady in question was separated from her husband so the child could never pass as hers. The conditions happened to make it workable that Osmond should acknowledge the little girl. His wife was dead, very true, but she had not been dead too long. He told the story of his wife having died in childbirth, and of his having, in grief and horror, banished the child for as long as possible to a nurse. The story passed sufficiently. His wife had died with her family in Piedmont. But of course I knew, although I've never spoken of it before. It was enough for me that the child was my niece. As for her veritable mother... The Countess had spoken no name, yet Isabel could but check on her own lips an echo of the unspoken. Why have you told me this? Because I've been so bored with your not knowing. Had it never occurred to you that Osmond was for 6 or 7 years Madame Merle's lover? I don't know. Things have occurred to me, and perhaps that was what they all meant. Isabel was silent a little. Why, then, did she want him to marry me? Oh, my dear, that's her superiority. You had money. She believed you would be good to Pansy. You've been made use of. Isabel made no answer to this. She only listened, and the Countess went on. They've always been bound to each other. When their little carnival was over, they made a bargain that each should do everything possible to help the other on. I know this by the way they behaved. Now, see how much better women are than men. She has found a wife for Osmond. She has worked for him, plotted for him, suffered for him. And the end of it is that he's tired of her. There are moments when he needs her, but on the whole, he wouldn't miss her if she were removed. And what's more, today she knows it. So you needn't be jealous, the Countess added humorously, laying her hand on Isabel's arm. Will you still give up your journey? There was a train for Paris that evening, and after the Countess had left her, Isabel had a rapid and decisive conference with her maid, who was discreet and devoted. After this, she drove to the convent to see Pansy. She was admitted to the parlor while the portress went to make it known that there was a visitor for the young lady. The portress shortly returned, ushering in another person. Isabel found herself confronted by Madame Merle. Isabel did not speak. You're surprised to find me here, and I'm afraid you're not pleased. I ought to have asked your permission. This was said simply and mildly. There was none of the oblique movement of irony. Madame Merle continued. I came to see Pansy because I thought she must be rather lonely. Of course, it's none of my business, but I feel happier since... There was a sudden break in her voice, a lapse in her continuity. Madame Merle had guessed in the space of an instant that everything was at an end between herself and her listener, and she had guessed the reason why. The person who stood there was not the same one she had seen hitherto, but a very different person, a person who knew her secret. I had better go to Pansy. I've come to say goodbye, our young woman said at last. I go to England tonight. Ralph Touchett is dying.
Ah, you'll feel that, said Madame Merle, recovering herself.
But Isabel turned and left the room. Outside, she met Sister Catherine, who showed her up a long staircase to Pansy's room. Isabel scarcely knew what she could say to her. I've come to bid you goodbye, she said eventually. I'm going to England.
To England?
Mr. Touchett is very ill. I wish to see him.
Oh, yes, of course you must go. But don't leave me here.
Isabel's heart beat fast. Will you come away with me now? Pansy looked at her pleadingly.
Did Papa tell you to bring me?
No.
I think I had better wait, then. Papa wished me to think a little, and I've thought a great deal.
What have you thought?
Well, that I must never displease Papa.
You knew that before.
Yes, but I know it better. I'll do anything. I'll do anything.
Then, as she heard her own words, a deep, pure blush came into her face. Isabel read the meaning of it. The poor girl had been vanquished. Isabel's time was rapidly shortening. Goodbye, then, Pansy. I leave Rome tonight, but I won't desert you. Then they held each other a moment in a silent embrace.
Madame Merle has been here,
Pansy remarked as Isabel stood at the top of the stairs.
I don't like Madame Merle.
Isabel hesitated. You must never say that, that you don't like Madame Merle. Pansy looked at her in wonder.
I never will again, then. But you'll come back?
Yes, I'll come back. As Isabel left the convent, she found Madame Merle waiting. This lady was now in full possession of her resources.
I wanted to ask you something about poor Mr. Touchett. Are you very fond of him?
Yes, I'm very fond of him, Isabel replied. But I don't understand you.
Well, I have an idea that your cousin once did you a great service.
He has done me many services.
Yes, but one was much above the rest. He made you a rich woman. It's him you have to thank for your brilliant marriage, said Madame Merle triumphantly.
It was my uncle's money,
but it was your cousin's idea.
Isabel stood staring.
What do you know?
Only what I've guessed. Then Isabel said it was her only revenge.
I believed it was you I had to thank.
Madame Merle stood there in a kind of proud penance.
You're very unhappy, I know, but I'm more so.
Yes, I can believe that.
I think I should like never to see you again.
I shall go to America, Madame Merle said quietly, and walked away.
It was with a feeling which in other circumstances would have had much of the effect of joy that as Isabel descended from the Paris mail at Charing Cross, she stepped into the arms of Henrietta Stackpole. She had telegraphed her friend from Turin. Henrietta was waiting with Mr. Bantling. This gallant bachelor advanced with a smile tempered, however, by the gravity of the occasion. He told Isabel that he had just come from Gardencourt. How is my dear cousin?
Poor Ralph is in bed and looks tremendously ill and he can't speak. But he was awfully jolly and funny all the same. It's very wretched.
Even in the crowded station, Isabel found this simple picture was vivid. Henrietta had arranged that Isabel should stay in London with her overnight and catch the early train from Paddington the next morning. And later, in a dusty parlour in Wimpole Street, the friend sat talking.
"Did your husband make a scene about your leaving?" Henrietta asked.
"Well, it wasn't what you call a scene.
What was it, then?"
"I'm tired, Henrietta. Let's not speak of it now. We've so little time. Tell me your adventures."
Well, I've been to stay with Lady Pensil.
Oh, the invitation came at last.
Yes, but this time she wanted to see me.
Henrietta blushed and stared at her friend.
Isabel Archer, I beg your pardon. I criticized you once, and yet I've gone further than you. Mr. Osmond at least was born in America.
Henrietta, are you going to give up your country?
Yes, I am. I'm going to marry Mr. Bantling and live in London.
Well, I'm very happy for you, said Isabel, smiling. But later, as she lay in bed, she felt a certain melancholy that Henrietta, whom she had hitherto regarded as a keen flame, a disembodied voice, should after all have confessed herself human and feminine. Isabel arrived at Gardencourt the following morning. She had left Wimpole Street early, and her only desire was to reach her much-embracing refuge. Gardencourt had been her starting point, and to those muffled chambers it was at least a temporary solution to return. Mrs. Touchett looked a great deal older as she greeted her. She had been sitting with Ralph for several hours.
"How is he?" Isabel asked.
"He's asleep most of the time. You can see him later on."
"Is there really no hope?"
"None whatever. There never has been. It has not been a successful life."
"No, it has only been a beautiful one."
"I don't know what you mean by that. There's no beauty without health," said Mrs. Touchett abruptly. "By the way, Lord Warburton's been to see Ralph and told him he's engaged to be married."
"To be married? Who's the young lady?"
"Oh, some member of the aristocracy."
"I'm very glad. It must be a sudden decision."
"Sudden enough, I believe. A courtship of 3 weeks."
"I'm very glad," Isabel repeated with a larger emphasis. Mrs. Touchett was watching her.
"Have you ever been sorry you didn't marry Lord Warburton?"
Isabel smiled. "No, dear aunt."
"Well, I suppose I'll have to believe you. But it's beyond me. Do you still like Serena Merle?" she went on.
"Not as I once did. She's going to America."
"To America? She must have done something very bad."
"Yes, very bad."
"May I ask what it is?"
"She made a convenience of me."
"Ah," cried Mrs. Touchett. "So she did of me."
It was not till the evening that Isabel was able to see Ralph. He had opened his eyes and recognized her as she sat by his bedside. But he was unable to speak. There was a strange tranquility on his face. On the evening of the third day, however, he spoke at last. They were alone.
"I feel better tonight," he murmured. "Don't people always feel better just before the end?"
Isabel sank down on her knees beside his pillow and sobbed.
"Oh, what is it you have done for me?"
he groaned.
"What is it you did for me?" she cried.
She had lost all her shame. Now she wished him to know, for it brought them supremely together.
"You did something once. You know it. Is it true that you made me rich? That all I have is yours?"
"Oh, don't speak of that. That was not happy. I believe I ruined you,"
he wailed. She was full of the sense that he was beyond the reach of pain. She wished to say everything. She was afraid he might die before she had done so.
"He married me for my money," she said. "I always tried to keep that from you."
She pressed her lips to the back of his hand.
"I always understood. Is it all over between you?"
"Oh, no. I don't think anything's over."
"Are you going back to him?"
Ralph gasped.
"I don't know.
I can't think of anything but you for the moment. Here, with you dying in my arms, I'm happier than I've been for a long time. And I want you to be happy and feel that I'm near you. And I love you.
Ralph evidently found greater difficulty in speaking.
I'm very tired. I wish I could stay.
For me, you'll always be here. Oh, Ralph.
Remember this, that if you've been hated, you've also been loved. Oh, but Isabel, adored.
He just audibly and lingeringly breathed. Ralph Touchett died peacefully in his sleep that night. When Isabel went to pay her respects the following morning, the person she saw on the bed was fairer than Ralph had ever been in life, and there was a strange resemblance to the face of his father. A surprising number of people attended the funeral 3 days later. Through her tear-filled eyes, Isabel noticed Caspar Goodwood. She had not realized he was still in England. She was aware of him staring at her, but he did not speak, and at the end of the service, he disappeared. Isabel made no immediate motion to leave Garden Court. She was happy to stay with her aunt for a while. Her errand was over. She had done what she had left her husband to do. She lived from day to day, postponing, trying not to think. She knew she must decide. Her coming itself had not been a decision. One afternoon, when Isabel was wandering alone in the garden, she saw Mrs. Touchett coming towards her, accompanied by Lord Warburton. He looked extremely self-conscious.
"Lord Warburton has called to see me," said Mrs. Touchett. "He didn't know you were still here."
"I'm catching the train for London at 6:30,
Mrs. Touchett's companion explained.
"I'm so glad to find you've not gone."
Mrs. Touchett turned discreetly away.
"My sisters would have come if they had known you were still here," Lord Warburton went on.
"It would have given me great pleasure to see them."
"I don't know whether you could come to Lockley for a day or two. You know there's always that old promise."
And his lordship coloured as he made this suggestion. "Thank you extremely."
"I have your promise, then?"
There was an interrogation in this, but Isabel let it pass.
"Take care you don't miss your train."
And then she added, "I wish you every happiness." He blushed again and looked at his watch.
"Yes, I must go. I haven't much time."
He said a very hurried goodbye, and in a moment the two ladies saw him striding across the lawn.
"Are you sure he's to be married?" Isabel asked her aunt.
"Well, I congratulated him, and he accepted it."
"Oh," said Isabel, "I give up."
Mrs. Touchett returned to the house, but Isabel sat on the bench and watched the sun go down. How long she sat there, she did not know. But the twilight had become thick when she suddenly realized she was not alone. Looking up, she saw Caspar Goodwood a few yards off, standing staring at her. He started forward and sat beside her on the bench.
"You frightened me," she said.
"I'm sorry, I didn't mean to. I waited for Lord Warburton to leave. I want to speak to you."
Goodwood spoke very fast.
"I came here from London today to help you."
"Help me?"
"Your cousin Ralph Touchett. He was a good man, a fine man, one of the best. He guessed my sentiments. He explained everything on our journey home. Do you know what he said to me the last time I saw him? He said, 'Do everything you can for her. Do everything she'll let you.'"
Isabel suddenly got up. "You had no business to talk about me."
"But even if Touchett had never opened his mouth, I should have known. You can't deceive me anymore. You're the most unhappy of women.
and your husband's the deadliest of fiends.
Are you mad? She cried.
I've never been so sane. I see the whole thing. You're afraid to go back. You don't know which way to turn. I want you, therefore, to turn to me.
Turn to you? Goodwood stared at her with his eyes shining.
Why shouldn't we be happy when it's so easy? I'm yours forever, forever and ever. You must save what you can of your life. You took the great step in coming away. The next is nothing. It's the natural one. We can do exactly as we please. Trust me.
Isabel gave a long murmur, like a creature in pain. Do me the greatest kindness of all, she panted. I beseech you to go away.
Oh, don't say that. Don't kill me.
Her eyes were streaming with tears. As you love me, as you pity me, leave me alone. He glared at her a moment. And then the next instant she felt his arms about her and his lips on hers. His kiss was like white lightning, a flash that spread and stayed. And it was extraordinarily as if, while she took it, she felt everything about him that at least pleased her. Each aggressive fact of his face, his figure, his presence, justified of its intense identity and made one with this act of possession. So had she heard of those wrecked and underwater, following a train of images before they sink. But when darkness returned, she was free. She never looked about her. She only darted from the spot and ran back toward the house. Only then did she pause. She had not known where to turn, but she knew now there was a very straight path. 2 days afterwards, Caspar Goodwood knocked at the door of Henrietta Stackpole's lodgings in Wimpole Street. Henrietta was just going out.
"I've come to see Mrs. Osmond," he said. "They told me at Gardencourt she was coming here."
"But she came yesterday, Mr. Goodwood. This morning she started for Rome." Caspar Goodwood stood staring at the floor.
"Oh, she started..."
Henrietta grasped his arm. "Look here, Mr. Goodwood. Just you wait." On which he looked up at her, but only to guess from her face with revulsion that she simply meant he was too young. She stood shining at him with that cheap comfort, and it added on the spot 30 years to his life. She walked him away with her, however, as if she had given him now the key to patience.